Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Well, this is a good week to remember Shakespeare, the arguably the greatest of English writers, poets, playwrights. I mean, this is the week he was born, baptized, and in fact died. So if we're ever going to talk about Shakespeare, this week in April is a good chance, good time to do it. And the person to talk with about Shakespeare is Joseph Pierce. Joseph is senior editor with the Augustine Institute and the author of several books dealing with Shakespeare, everything from The Quest for Shakespeare, The Bard of Avon and the Church of Rome, to Shakespeare on Love, to Through Shakespeare's Eyes, where he analyzes three of the plays of Shakespeare from a Catholic perspective. And he's also done the series, The Quest for Shakespeare, on EWTN. And Joseph, good to have you back here.
It's good to be back, Al.
So this is a good week to talk about Shakespeare, right? Those dates are all right?
Absolutely all right, yeah. He was born on St. George's Day, April 23rd. He died on St. George's Day, April 23rd, and was baptized on April 25th, St. Mark's Day.
Now, he is, how well accepted is it among academics that Shakespeare was either himself a Catholic or was influenced with or by Catholic sympathies?
Yeah, well, I think that basically that the tide has swung pretty dramatically over the last 15 or 20 years towards a general acceptance that Shakespeare was raised in a devoutly and defiantly Catholic home during a time of Catholic persecution, and that the battle now is not so much on that ground, because I think that ground has been largely conceded by the secular academy. The battle now is the extent to which Shakespeare remained a Catholic, or the extent to which he didn't. And of course, the focus of much of my work is to show, from the evidence of his life and from the evidence from the texts of his work, that he remained a Catholic, at least in sympathy, but I actually think in secret practice throughout all of his life.
Critics like Harold Bloom said Shakespeare seems too wise to believe anything, political or religious.
I mean, the absurdity of that statement, really, I mean, you know, so someone who's wise has no beliefs at all? I mean, what does that mean? I mean, it's such an absurd statement that it really doesn't even need comment except to say that Harold Bloom should not be taken seriously.
When dealing with Shakespeare, certainly. At that time, it would not have been easy for Shakespeare to either declare himself a Catholic or even to do, quote, religious drama, right?
Yeah, I mean, we need to a good analogy, I think, for moderns such as us is the Soviet Union. Now, if you had an active dissident community in the Soviet Union, we think perhaps of Alexander Solzhenitsyn and others, but there's very little paper trail being left behind, because a paper trail just enables you to be arrested and thrown into prison. So that's the challenge that we face in looking at the Catholics in Elizabeth's England, because Catholicism was illegal. To be a Catholic priest in England was not only illegal, it was punishable by death. To harbour a Catholic priest in England by any member of the laity was also punishable by death. So, and in other words, that if you're going to practice your faith, you have to do it in a secret fashion. And as regards contemporary religion and politics, it was illegal to talk about contemporary religious and politics on the stage. So Shakespeare got around this by setting his plays in foreign countries, which of course are Catholic, or in the past. You only have to go back in his time, half a century, and all of England prior to that was Catholic. So plays or plays set on the continent allowed Shakespeare to have his dramas in the Catholic milieu without breaking the law.
Interesting. So, I mean, so the Catholic Church was really operating underground from about the middle of the 16th century on. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Basically, you know, that Catholic priests, particularly and especially Jesuit priests, were being smuggled into England and were living, in disguise, disguised as gardeners or school teachers, obviously not wearing priestly clothes, because it would be instant arrest, torture, and death. So, you know, that we have to be aware of that. It was a time of priest holes. and such like. So this is the world in which Shakespeare is living and writing.
Yeah, I think this is, it's difficult for us to understand that, because when we think of England, of course, we think about the nation that we have a special here in the United States, we have a special relationship with England. We feel as though we derive our sense of rights from them, our language. And so it's difficult to remember that at one time there was, and for centuries, there was such severe brute force persecution of Catholics, that Catholics were unable to declare themselves citizens. They were unable to vote. And it's just hard. I think it's hard for people to think of England being in that condition. I think the Soviet Union analogy is a good one. How would Solzhenitsyn have written freely about many topics had he stayed in the Soviet Union?
Right, exactly. He was forced out in the end, and he couldn't write freely. His works were all in what was called samizdat, which is basically in our hand-copied manuscript, mm-hmm. because nothing could be published there. I mean, what I would say about England, you know, obviously I'm biased, being an Englishman, but, but you know, the Magna Carta was from Catholic England, so that the English law, the English legal system, goes back to the pre-Reformation times, and I would say that we should sympathise with those heroic Catholic Englishmen that for 300 years of persecution stayed defiantly with the faith, and that's the England to which I owe my loyalty, not the England of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I and the other tyrants.
Well, as you know, Joe, I just got back from England visiting my daughter, son-in-law at Oxford, and we visited London, and thanks to you, I was able to meet with several Catholics in England. And I have to say, the one thing I came back with, it was a great trip, but one thing I came back with is that American Catholics are simply unaware of English Catholicism and its history and what we owe English Catholicism. And I am interested in somehow helping build some bridges here intellectually so that American Catholics can better understand what we owe members of our faith who suffered for the faith during those terrible years, and right up and through 19th and even into the 20th century a bit. So I'll talk with you about that project.
Well, obviously, it would make us allies on yet another level, Al. Obviously, we've been allies on all sorts of levels over the years, and that's a great blessing to me. But obviously, one of my preoccupations, if you like, of my apostolate is to try to make this Catholic England better known to Catholics over here. So, yeah, if you and I could work together with that, I would consider that an honor and a blessing.
Yes, well, we'll get together on that, because I'll tell you, it was heartbreaking to see so much Christian presence in Oxford, and yet to also know that at the time that Benedict XVI went there to beatify John Henry Newman, that there was actually resistance to the Pope's visit. So there's still some anti-Catholic prejudice that remains, although they did put up a plaque for Newman, I guess, at St. Mary's there, which I thought was surprising.
Yeah, thinking back of that and remembering that historic trip to England, Benedict XVI, what I thought was amazing was the miracle that accompanied his arrival, because prior to that, the secular media and the secular fundamentalists and the remnant of the Protestant fundamentalists were all united in you know, we don't want this Pope over here for all their particular agendas, and yet when he actually arrived, there was this just groundswell. They said nobody would arrive to visit, to see him on his as he travelled around London and to the various masses, and they were all incredibly well attended, and I think everybody was surprised, and somehow or other, Pope Benedict, and one has to think it's the grace of God, managed to win the heart of even many of the skeptics, and I was astonished at the workings of divine grace during that trip. Yeah. It's one, a very special memory of mine.
Yes. Let's returning to Shakespeare here. He's it's well accepted that he was raised in a Catholic family, in a defiant Catholic family, a family that wasn't laying down. He was born, I think, 1564. So this is just after the Catholic Church has been forced underground. And did he have any aspirations to priesthood?
Well, not that we're aware. The one thing that we don't know about Shakespeare, and it's one of the most enigmatic things, is exactly where he did receive his education, because the most likely place would be Stratford Grammar School, which would have been a very good education, and most of his school teachers, or many of his school teachers, were Catholics. There's been some great research done on that. But if he didn't get his education from there, he would have gone to abroad, which is where many Catholic youngsters went abroad, and that's where many of them did become inspired for the vocation to the priesthood. But there's no evidence that Shakespeare was one of them. If he did study abroad, he returned home again as a layman. He got married, he had children. So I don't think there's any evidence that Shakespeare ever felt he had a vocation for the priesthood.
Any connection with figures like Father Campion?
Well, yes. I mean, there's circumstantial evidence that Shakespeare may well have known St. Edmund Campion shortly before Campion's arrest and torture and execution. Shakespeare would have been a teenager working as a schoolmaster in the north of England. There's been quite a lot of done on these so-called lost years. I write about it in my books, but I put more emphasis upon the stronger evidence that Shakespeare would have known a later Jesuit who was an almost exact contemporary of Shakespeare called St. Robert Southwell. St. Robert Southwell basically ministered to London's Catholics. Of course, Shakespeare was in London most of the time during this period, and St. Robert Southwell had the Earl of Southampton, who was Shakespeare's patron, the Earl of Southampton had Southwell as his personal confessor. And I think it's entirely possible, bearing in mind how close Shakespeare was to the Earl of Southampton and how relatively small the Catholic community was in London, which was the heart of the beast, that Shakespeare would have known Southwell well, and it's entirely possible, if that's the case, that he had St. Robert Southwell as his own personal confessor, which is a fascinating prospect.
Wow. His wedding, was that presided over by a priest?
Yeah, basically Shakespeare seems to have gone to a great deal of trouble to, if you like, circumvent existing laws, which said that you have to get married in your local parish, where, you know, the parish boundaries in which you live, and he managed to find a way of getting around that to actually get married in a nearby parish where there was a Marian priest. In other words, priests that were ordained under the reign of Mary Tudor, who were known to be Catholics, sympathetic to Catholicism. So in other words, he went to quite great pains to actually be married by a Catholic.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Joseph Pierce, senior editor with the Augustine Institute, the author of a great literary biographer and a student of Shakespeare as well. His book, Quest for Shakespeare, then Shakespeare's Eyes, also Shakespeare on Love, takes a look at the question of Shakespeare's worldview, especially his Catholic connection, and the degree to which he thought and imagined as a Catholic. And I think, you know, despite the anti-Catholic bias that pervaded Shakespeare's world, Joseph has been able to discover expressions in Shakespeare's writings of Catholic faith, Catholic sympathies, especially for those suffering under the anti-Catholic reign of Queen Elizabeth, King James I. And what do people say to those obvious Catholic sympathies, Joe?
Well, I mean, I think that for Catholics, there's a great deal of consolation and fortitude that we can actually gain from knowing that this great writer stayed true to the faith in a time of great persecution. Of course, for those admirers of Shakespeare, and there, of course, are many of all shades of opinion who are opposed to Christianity in general and Catholicism in particular, the discovery of more and more evidence of Shakespeare's Catholicism is actually not welcome and actually seen by many as a threat. And we should also bear in mind that there there are many, many, numerous, hundreds of academics out there in the secular academy that have built reputations upon a misreading and misunderstanding of Shakespeare.
Yes.
So the increasing evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism is basically bringing their scholarly status into disrepute and into question. So there's no doubt at all that in the secular academy, the emergence of the evidence for the Catholic Shakespeare is indeed an unwelcome threat.
Yeah, I mean, because it does calls into question the reputation of many academics. I mean,
if academics have built a reputation on a false reading of Shakespeare, where basically what many of them do is just turn Shakespeare into a 21st century, secular relativist. In other words, somebody who mirrors their own prejudices, and then you can show that that just isn't the case from just objective evidence from the text of the plays and from the biographical evidence of Shakespeare's life, then it does really pull the rug out from under them. So it's a very unwelcome branch of scholarship. This evidence we're getting for Shakespeare's Catholicism.
Now, you in Through Shakespeare's Eyes, you take a look at three plays of Shakespeare and analyze the Catholic content, draw attention to the Catholic content or the Catholic dynamic of those plays. Let me ask you before we go to those about the poem the Phoenix and Turtle. Is that authentically Shakespeare?
Oh yes, absolutely authentically Shakespeare. I don't think anybody doubts that. What is in question is what on earth it's about, because it's very much a conundrum. It's a puzzle, there's been some good scholarship done by John Klaus and others. Connecting the Phoenix and the Turtle to Catholic martyrs, particularly St. Anne Line, who was martyred, and William Byrd, who wasn't martyred but was a defiant recusant at the time that Shakespeare's around, and allusions to other Jesuits, to Jesuit priests such as Robert Southwell. So it's seen as a cryptic allusion to the situation of Catholics in England. The phoenix, of course, is a bird that rises from the dead. The turtle is the turtle dove, of course, an image of the Holy Spirit and mm-hmm. also of sanctity.
What is his in his plays? What role do Catholic clergy play? What's his general attitude towards clergy?
Yeah, well, basically, the Catholic clergy are normally portrayed very positively. I mean, not in the sense that they're all depicted as saints, but in many plays, I think perhaps of Romeo and Juliet, the priest characters are the ones that convey whatever wisdom is there in a play, basically okay. characterized for the most part by the absence of wisdom, and it's the failing to heed those words of timely wisdom that caused the debacle or the tragedy within the plot. So generally speaking, monks, religious sisters, we think perhaps of Measure for Measure, the depictions of religious sisters, monks, priests, are astonishingly positive, considering that the time in which Shakespeare is writing, because most of his contemporaries, other playwrights, were just writing very knee-jerk, negative, stereotypical attacks upon Catholicism in general and the clergy in particular.
So Christopher Marlowe, he depicts Catholics and Catholic clergy as villainous?
Well, I mean, Marlowe's an enigma in himself because, he seems to have been sympathetic to Catholicism, seems perhaps to have converted to Catholicism, and yet he also seems to have been a spy, so we don't know to what extent any conversion was genuine or merely cynical.
Wow. Yeah.
Certainly in a play like The Jew of Malta, it seems to display cynicism, and yet, in Dr. Faustus, he also seems to display a sense of repentance for the sort of life that he's lived. So he's a difficult character, not one to be trusted, that's for sure.
Okay, gotcha. Take Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet, which I know you've written on Romeo and Juliet. Is he a figure that ends up offering the wisdom that you're referring to earlier? Is he the one who gives the moral counsel?
Yeah, I mean, what we find in the depiction of Friar Lawrence and Romeo and Juliet is Shakespeare at his best. In other words, he doesn't. Shakespeare gives us real characters in the fullness of their complexity. In other words, not just two-dimensional figures. So the words of wisdom, the words of Christian philosophy and morality in the play, which we can see are quite clearly what's lacking in the characters, and that's the problem, are given by Friar Lawrence.
Okay.
But, you know, in a rather naive effort to bring peace between the families, he becomes embroiled in an effort to bring reconciliation through the marriage of Romeo and Juliet, which was against canon law at the time. Mm-hmm. So he was being disobedient. And at the end of the play, we see him as a repentant figure, as one who apologizes for his sins, is willing to accept and embrace whatever punishment comes for his role in the tragedy, but we have the final judgment on him coming from the prince, who says, "We still have known thee as a holy man."
As a holy man.
In other
yeah.
words, in spite of everything, you are a holy man, and everyone knows you as such. So that's yeah. the final judgment of Friar Lawrence in the play.
So he admits his complicity. He repents. He's ready to receive punishment, and then he's exculpated by the prince.
Exactly, he's forgiven. If you like, absolved. If you want to use that phraseology.
Sure.
And of course, that's the final judgment of the prince, who, if, in many ways, as he winds the play up and brings all the loose ends together, is the final judgment of the poet, of Shakespeare himself. So he's depicted to us in Friar Lawrence, you know, a man who perhaps is guilty of a naivete in his idealism and perhaps even cowardice, but is very aware of those flaws and confesses and is forgiven for them.
Okay. Let's take Friar Francis from Much Ado About Nothing. He's not as long-winded as Friar Lawrence, but he plays a pivotal role. How do you regard him?
Much Ado About Nothing. One of those comedies I don't know very well, Al, so okay. you're going to have to enlighten me more on it. I don't think I know enough about it to actually say anything eloquent.
Well, I think it seems to me to be the pivotal figure that moves the play from tragedy to its comic resolution. So I'll leave it there so we won't go into it. But he interrupts what happens is he interrupts the proceedings at one point to defend the innocent hero, and ends up defending the maiden, calling on his experience as a confessor and a confidant. And
I've never written a study Much Ado About Nothing. I think I've heard it once, so I'm not an expert, and I'm very happy to have been enlightened. And it's obviously yet another piece of evidence that I can pick up and write on at some point.
I think so. I have to confess, I'm more a student of the movie than I am of the play. So let's go on. How did he treat sacraments?
Well, whenever the sacraments are treated in the plays, they're treated with a Catholic reverence. We have the confession scene in Romeo and Juliet. We have the Merchant of Venice, the imagery surrounding the Blessed Sacrament in the wonderful speech of Lorenzo, where he likens the stars to the pattern during the Mass. Wherever the sacraments are alluded to, and of course they're not alluded to explicitly, except where we have an authentic Catholic setting to do it. But wherever they are alluded to, it's always positive. And in fact, if any of your listeners have the opportunity, there's a wonderful book by two German scholars called Mutschmann and Ventersdorf, and there's a section in that book about Shakespeare's use of his depiction of the sacraments in his works.
Very good. Now, what in the plays that you examined, I think King Lear was one of them. What did you find most compelling?
Well, about King Lear, the most important thing about King Lear, and of course this is something which is universally applicable in all times, including our own, but perhaps particularly applicable in Shakespeare's time, is that we, A, have to embrace suffering, and that suffering is the path to, should we say, spiritual growth. But also, and within that, we see in the character of Cordelia, one who is asked basically to render unto Caesar the things that are God's and refuses to do so, and is sent into exile, disinherited and sent into exile for her refusal, basically, to render unto Caesar the things that are God's. And, of course, for in Shakespeare's time, when that's exactly what was being demanded of the Catholics, that the state religion imposed by Henry VIII and carried on by Elizabeth I and James I was basically compulsory. That was the only acceptable religion, the state religion. And Catholics, in refusing to bow the knee before Caesar, were punished. So in the beautiful character of Cordelia in King Lear, we see that. We also see, you know, the hope, if you like, that King Lear sees the error of his own ways, and I think Shakespeare always perhaps hoped that that the monarch would listen to the plays and learn the lessons, and alas, that wasn't to be the case.
Now, what about in Hamlet? Is there a presentation of purgatory there, and would that have been significant?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Basically, the ghost in Hamlet announces that he is in purgatory because he was killed in the fullness of his sins without having the opportunity through the last sacrament, for the last rites, or through the sacrament of confession to have his sins forgiven prior to his death. Because he was murdered, he's now in purgatory. Now, the question is, you know, is the ghost an... to use Hamlet's own words, Hamlet goes to great trouble within the play to prove to himself, and indeed to us as the audience, that the ghost is an honest ghost. If the ghost is an honest ghost, then he is in purgatory. And of course, if purgatory exists, that is itself a vindication of the Catholic perspective, because purgatory was effectively, the belief in purgatory was effectively outlawed in Shakespeare's time.
Hmm. So I think it's important, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to look for the Catholic Shakespeare, then going back to what you said originally, you've got to keep in mind that he's writing in a place where it was illegal to flaunt one's Catholic identity, and he had to walk this tightrope. And I think that's critical. Now, again, I want to emphasize Joseph's books, Through Shakespeare's Eyes, The Quest for Shakespeare, Shakespeare on Love, all available in the EWTN Religious Catalog. Joseph, thank you so much for being with me today.
My pleasure as always, Al.